Hello, and welcome to the Cautionary Tales edition of Slate Money, your guide to business, finance, and all manner of weird 2,500-year-old cautionary tales. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, and I'm in a fabulous recording studio in Oxfordshire with none other than Mr. Tim Harford. Hi, Tim. What are you plugging?
So, as you know, Felix, I work for the Financial Times, but I am plugging a new podcast called Cautionary Tales. It is out in a first season of 8 episodes, and it is full of stories about all kinds of mishaps, fiascos, heists, crashes, disasters, catastrophes, and in each case, a little bit of zesty social science. What can we actually learn from what went wrong, from these true stories of disaster, and how can we avoid meeting such terrible fates ourselves?
And, of course, we are joined from Brooklyn by Anna Szymanski of Breaking Views. Hi, Anna.
Hello.
We are going to talk about all of these weird cautionary tales, or at least a couple of them, on this episode. We're going to talk about Christmas cards, because 'tis the season. And I kind of want to talk about the black market in Chinese sand, which is one of my favorite stories of the year. All of that coming up on Slate Money. So, Tim, you are applying social science and some kind of economics and that kind of thing to a bunch of stories of, as you say, thefts and disasters. And whenever people do this, I think of a conversation I had with Danny Kahneman once, the great economist and behavioral economist.
Well, a psychologist, really, we should say. But a psychologist so awesome, they gave him the Nobel Prize in economics anyway.
Exactly. And he did a whole bunch of research into our biases and the things which we kind of just wind up doing, even though, like, really we know we shouldn't do them and probably don't even want to do them. And I said, well, you've discovered all of these biases. Isn't that great? Because now we can overcome our biases. And he's like, don't be stupid. Just because you know they're there doesn't mean you can stop doing it. And so the whole premise of your podcast kind of worries me on some level, because I have this idea that I'm going
to
listen.
It is supposed to make you feel anxious. They are supposed to worry you.
I'm going to learn about all of these mistakes that are just human and that people make, and then I'm going to do them anyway, and I'm going to go, but Tim told me not to do them, and there's not. Do you think that if I listen to your podcast, that will in any way stop me from making these mistakes?
Yes. I mean, one of the episodes is all about the lessons from that time they gave the Oscar to La La Land, when in fact it should have gone to Moonlight. And I explain the implications for the financial crisis and nuclear meltdowns and so on. But the point I make is that in that case, the superficial story is the accountant in the wings gave the wrong envelope to Warren Beatty, and then Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway went on stage and they didn't really know what was going on, and so they read out the wrong film because they had the wrong envelope. And so some people say, well, it's Warren Beatty's fault, and some people say it's Faye Dunaway's fault, and most people say it's Brian Cullinan's fault. Brian Cullinan,
Starstruck accountant.
Yes, who was tweeting photographs of Emma Stone from backstage when he should have been giving the right envelope to Warren Beatty. But the point is, if you just sit there and go, well, it was human error, it was a human mistake, we need better humans, not going to happen. But is there a better way to design the system? Yes. And in that particular case, I go back to the work of the sociologist Charles Perrow, who sadly died quite recently, an expert in disaster. And I go all the way back to Galileo, who wrote about this kind of problem.
People have been relying on smart humans for a long time. I remember having this conversation a lot during the financial crisis, where people were like, the humans were dumb and they should have been smarter.
Never works.
And then I was like, yeah, but that whole point of a financial system that's remotely robust is it needs to be robust to dumb humans.
Yes, absolutely.
Anna, do you think that we can ever build an economy or a financial system that is robust to dumb humans?
Probably not 100%, but I do think it's interesting to look at, you know, some of the algorithmic trading systems and how they are somewhat trying to counter those biases. Now, of course, those algorithms are originally kind of created by humans, so that's an issue. But in theory, some of they're supposed to be kind of self-teaching. So, you know, maybe at some point, the, you know, the fewer and fewer humans we have and the more and more machines, maybe the key.
I really don't buy that. Tim and I, just before we started recording, were talking about the Gaussian copula function, which was...
As we do.
As you do.
Just when, hanging like, out
when,
in the
when
studio.
When Tim and I hanging out in recording studios, what we talk about is the Gaussian copula function. And for those Slate Money listeners who don't know what I'm talking about, I wrote a big cover story about it for Wired in April 2009, which predates Slate Money. But it's basically exactly what you're talking about, Anna, which is an algorithm which was trained on a whole bunch of market prices and didn't have any real human input and wound up more or less destroying the entire global financial system. So on one level, I just don't buy it. Tim, do you buy it?
You can certainly try to make the system more robust. I mean, one of the issues that people who think about accidents and why accidents happen, one of the issues that comes up a lot is that people put safety systems in place, and the safety systems just create new ways for things to fail because they make it more and more and more complicated. There are certain ways of thinking about safety that make things simpler and certain ways that make it more complicated.
I think it's interesting, you know, to look at, you know, different funds and how they've used these kind of more complicated trading systems and why some have done well and some have failed. And I feel like you have something like long-term capital management, and they believe...
Of blessed memory.
Yes. They believe that their system was so perfect that then they took these outlandish risks because they thought, well, no, you know, this can't possibly fail. Where you have other places like, you know, Renaissance Technology, where they clearly seem to understand that the models couldn't be perfect. And so you had to kind of mitigate risk because they knew it couldn't be perfect. So I think maybe that's a little bit of the balance.
But I think both of them are risk takers. I think what we saw in the financial crisis was that people were buying a whole bunch of AAA rated mortgage-backed securities, not because they were convinced that they had the mathematical ability to calculate the risk, but precisely because they were what's known as informationally insensitive investors, and they just saw that AAA rating, and that'll do. That means there's no risk there. And all of this money started piling into them without really people thinking about it because they felt they didn't need to think about it because it had a AAA rating. And I think that's a little bit what Tim is talking about, that when you build a safety system, like the AAA rating is in its own way a safety system. It's a way of saying you're safe now, you're on safe ground.
And the credit default swap, I think, is a more direct parallel, where you say, don't worry about this, you're insured by these guys called AIG, who, by the way, have written $2,700 billion worth of insurance for other people. But don't worry, I'm sure nothing possibly could go wrong with that scheme.
But there is a way, that there's one safety mechanism, Anat Admati at Stanford University is famously quite keen on a safety system for banks, at least, where she says banks should just have way, way more equity than they do right now, right? Banks, by their nature, are highly leveraged institutions. Before the financial crisis, they were like 30 to 1. Now they're more like 10 to 1. And she's like, no, they should be like 1 to 1 or maybe 2 to 1 leverage. They should have lots more equity and fund themselves much less with debt. And that would just make them safer. Do you buy that one? I think she's right about that, isn't she?
So I think that on the one hand, having banks, especially more systemic banks, having a bigger capital buffer, a bigger equity buffer, makes some sense. But I think when you're talking about expanding it to those extreme levels, I really start to question what would be the side effects of that, because you would be making the banks less profitable. And if you're making that bank less profitable, they're going to take risks in other ways. So I'm not saying that it's possible that you might make part of the system less apt to the type of crises we saw in the past, but my guess is it would then create some type of other issue that would create a crisis that we can't even really foresee now.
Can I talk about a 2,500-year-old antecedent to the financial crisis and the Gaussian copula function?
This is only if it involves an oracle.
Yes.
Because I feel like, that was the other thing we were talking about earlier, that if you were a young woman in ancient Greece, your job opportunities were maybe not quite as broad as, say, you know, Anna Shymansky has available. You couldn't go become a blogger or a podcaster, but the best job, I'm convinced about this, was to become an oracle.
Yeah, you could then speak with the voice of Apollo himself. That is a wonderful gig. I mean, I've got no idea whether it was a wonderful gig, but it was a culturally significant gig. So people who wanted their questions about the future answered would go to the oracles. The most famous oracle was at the Temple of Delphi, and they would make offerings, and this priestess, speaking with the voice of a god, would answer their questions. And I relate in one of the episodes of Cautionary Tales, I talk about this famous story where King Croesus of Lydia, the fabulously wealthy King Croesus, goes to the oracle and says, "Shall I invade the Persian Empire?" And the oracle says, "Well, if you go to war with Persia, you will destroy a mighty empire." And Croesus goes, "That sounds great. Let's go to war." And of course, he's defeated and he does destroy a mighty empire. It's his own. But I spoke to a professor of ancient history, who's a friend of mine, who thinks about what the oracles meant to the Greeks. And her point is, the Greeks knew when you ask an oracle, that's not the end of it. It just like when you consult the Gaussian copula function, just like when you look and you see that something's AAA rated, just like when you check out your GPS and your GPS says that this is the right way to go. That's just the start. You can't just accept what's coming out of that black box, whether the black box is a priestess or whether the black box is your phone or whether the black box is a financial algorithm, a financial function. You need to then think about the answer. And the legend of King Croesus is all about a guy who didn't think about the answer he got, which, by the way, was perfectly accurate.
So I want to do a whole extra segment. We're going to have a whole segment on GPS in a minute.
Yeah.
But is it actually realistic for us to treat our GPS with skepticism? But I feel like it's so built into our lives in so many ways that at some point you have this sort of heuristic of the GPS is right. And we just don't have the mental capacity to treat everything, including a GPS, with that kind of level of skepticism.
Well, but I think it depends on the circumstance, right? Because if you're looking at your GPS and you're trying to say, like, the arrow seems to be pointing this way, but I think I'm supposed to go the other way, and you follow the GPS and it's wrong, like, that might not be a bigger issue. But if you know you're near the edge of a cliff, then that becomes a much bigger issue. So I think it all comes down to, you know, where you're putting your energies in terms of where you're skeptical depends on the circumstance.
Or one of the stories that I tell in the podcast, which is that terrible story about a woman who drove through Death Valley relying on her GPS. She didn't have a map and the GPS let her down. We're not sure exactly why, whether it was malfunctioning, whether it had the wrong map, whether the connection was faulty, whether she misread it. We don't know the details, but it did not end well. It is 115 degrees in the shade and the GPS got her lost. And the lesson there is, okay, fine, if you're just going to drive down to a restaurant that you've not been to before, fine, rely on the GPS. If you're going through Death Valley, bring a map, make sure you got a phone signal, make sure you got water. You are betting your life that this thing is going to work, and you shouldn't be betting your life that it's going to work.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
So let's continue on the subject of GPS, and specifically GPS around the port of Shanghai. And specifically the way that the port of Shanghai, just like all ports, is really run on GPS, which is this glorious technology, which is subsidized by the US government and allows everyone in the world to know where they are at all points. Great public good. And they put little GPS transponders onto all of the ships so that if you're navigating this incredibly busy waters around Shanghai, you know where all the ships are at all times and you don't run into them. And this works perfectly well, doesn't it, Tim?
It works perfectly well until it doesn't. There's this astonishing story in the MIT Technology Review.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant piece of storytelling as well, where a captain of a ship is just looking at other ships on his GPS screen, and the ship just disappears, and then it appears in dock, and then it appears back on the river, and then it goes back to dock, and he's, what's going on? And then he realizes the ship has never actually moved at all, but where it is on his GPS locator keeps changing, and thus begins the story of what is happening to GPS in Shanghai.
And it turns out to be this thing called GPS spoofing, which I, for one, had no idea even existed. But of course, like the minute you say GPS spoofing, it's like, of course it exists.
Mm-hmm. That must be a thing.
And the idea is that if you're a criminal with certain incentives, you have the incentive to make people think that certain boats are in certain places at certain times. And rather than moving the boats, you just spoof their GPS system and everyone just knows that that's where the boat is because everyone conflates the GPS signal with the boat.
Absolutely. One of the things that fascinated me about this story was just that the guesses as to who might be trying to do that. Was it the Chinese government or was it, and this sounds like a thing that definitely must exist in Star Wars, was it sand pirates?
It was sand pirates. So Anna, did you read the story?
I did.
And how awesome is the concept of sand pirates?
I think that is pretty amazing. And it also just brings into the lens like how important cement has been to kind of the growth in China. And obviously you need sand to create cement.
So just to rewind here, since we're talking about 2,500-year-old, stories, concrete is a 2,500-year-old technology. Actually, more than that. It's like a 4,000-year-old technology.
If you consult my book, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy, it's about a 10,000-year-old technology. They found concrete in ancient Turkey. But the reinforced concrete is much more recent, of course. But yes, as the point that Anna's making about the importance of the sand for concrete, which is this incredibly important building technology, desert sand won't do.
Tell us about sand in China. What is going on with sand in China, and why would the need for sand to build Chinese cities result in GPS spoofing in the port of Shanghai?
Well, I just caveat that my knowledge of sand politics is somewhat limited, but it appears that the type of sand that you could kind of, I believe, like dredge up in these ports, near these ports, was the type of sand that is the best type of sand for the building materials that people want to make. And consequently, because of that, what you've seen is a lot of sand from different areas has been taken, then it's caused a lot of problems. And so consequently, the Chinese government has put caps and strict limits on the sand that can be taken. And
which
just
always works,
like
right?
Anytime you have something that's profitable and you put caps on it, you create a black market.
So this is the glorious thing. So basically what you have is these boats trawling the river, literally trawling the river, sticking these big pipes down to the riverbed.
In the middle of the night,
pulling up hundreds of tons of riverbed sand, because riverbed sand is the best sand to be making cement out of.
Do you know why, by the way?
No, tell me why.
It's because desert sand, because there is a lot of sand in the Sahara, for example. Like, there's plenty of sand. It's too smooth. It's been blown by the wind, and it's spherical. Whereas the ocean sand from beaches, sand from rivers, hasn't been rubbed smooth and is not spherical. It's kind of all knobbly. Apparently. I am not a sand engineer, but that is my understanding.
But it stands to reason that knobbly sand would be better for making cement, because you want it to stick to itself.
We all sound very authoritative on this point.
Yes,
now.
Yes.
No one is going to say
we've all read one article.
I mean, I'm you know, as everyone knows, I'm a bit of a brutalism nerd, and I love concrete, and I have studied that, but I have not really. Well, the one thing I know about concrete is that it's very local, that concrete buildings in cities like, Boston, concrete buildings are generally redder and Manhattan concrete buildings are generally grayer and that kind of thing.
Because the sand is heavy.
Because sand is heavy, and so you just use the local sand, and local sand has its own local coloring. And that kind of feeling of terroir in concrete is one of the things that I absolutely love. But, you know, it turns out that the best Pinot Noir grapes of China are not Pinot Noir grapes at all. They're Yangtze River sand, or whichever river is in Shanghai. I'm quite bad on geography. And these pirates want to just import their sand into the port under dead of night. And the way they do that is by making everyone think that all of the other ships are moving around in a perfect circle.
We think. Right. We're not sure. We still don't know. But yes, one of the lovely details from this article was that if you looked at everyone's Strava routes, because Strava works on GPS, it's this tracking system that people sign up for, if they're cyclists or if they're joggers. And the people who were investigating this realized that everyone's Strava routes were suddenly forming like this perfect circle in the middle of Shanghai. And it's like, I don't think that everyone is just cycling around and around and around.
Which there's also reminds me of the time that a secret CIA base was discovered on Strava. Do you remember that story, Anna?
I do remember that story. And I say this because I am an avid Strava user. And yeah, it was basically because, you know, if you run or you cycle, as Tim said, you're going to be using this. And you had people on this base using their Strava. And then people realize, oh, it looks like, you know, all of these Americans just happen to be running in this particular area. And it does raise that, you know, that question as more and more of us use this type of technology that's tied to our location, that just opens up all of these other fields for potentially crime or, you know, or espionage or whatever.
The metadata matters, it turns out.
So, Anna, as the neoliberal with the market solution to all problems, what is the market solution to the problem of river pirates in China? Sand pirates, I should say.
Sand pirates, yeah. I mean, it's a good question because, I mean, I think there's a very good reason why you don't want all of this river sand to be taken, because that is going to have a clear economic impact. Maybe there's some way that you could kind of factor in that negative externality or something to kind of the price, so that you could get these people kind of out of this underground economy into the actual economy. I don't know. I mean, there is not a great solution to sand piracy, because, you know, just like any type of piracy,
sand,
like when you have a good that is very valuable, then people are probably going to want to get it.
And this is not even the weirdest sand piracy story. I mean, there was a whole beach in the Caribbean stolen, I seem to remember, a couple of years ago. Somebody just came and stole the beach. Does happen.
For concrete or just to move the beach somewhere else?
I forget.
No, I think yellow sandy beaches, like that sand is super valuable in like beach resorts where the sand has a habit of blowing away or getting washed away.
But so just they think always about have to import the beautiful new sand. Brutalist buildings you could make. Think about that terroir.
A golden concrete. If anyone has examples of like golden sand getting turned into concrete and making a beautiful golden concrete building, let me know, because I will make a pilgrimage.
This segment went to some very weird places.
It did go to some very strange places.
I like it.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, you need to give us the TLDR of your Christmas card story, which is glorious.
Yeah, so people used to send more holiday cards in the past, but I was really struck. 1974, a sociologist called Phil Kuntz Not sure how to pronounce the name.
On the radio. Kunz.
Yes.
How would you say that? Anyway, K-U-N-Z. Philip Kunz, shall we say. Philip Kunz received just this enormous number of holiday cards. And the reason he had received so many is because he and a colleague had sent out 600 cards to total strangers picked at random from the phone book. And some got these very high status cards with very fancy calligraphy and or from Dr. and Mrs. Kunz. And some of them were much kind of lower status. They were from Phil and Joyce. And more than 100 people felt obliged to reply to these cards, including an extraordinary reply where this group invited themselves and their children and their St. Bernards for a week's holiday with the Kunz family.
Which is glorious.
Yeah, which is absolutely brilliant. And they had no idea who these people are, but they were like, oh yeah, we remember you. We're going to come and stay with you.
Which is, I mean, all power to them. You get a Christmas card from someone who sounds like they're quite rich, who are on the way to this place where you're going on holiday, and you're like, well, rather than pay for a hotel, why don't we just stay with these people who send us a Christmas card? If they sent us a Christmas card, they can't be that bad.
Yeah, they must know
something.
Especially
if they're looking after our St. Bernards.
So I think it's a really interesting illustration of this kind of grim circle of reciprocity that the Christmas card list sometimes engenders, sort of people just feeling obliged to send Christmas cards because they receive Christmas cards. And there's a bit of social climbing too, because the people who received the high status Christmas cards were more likely to respond. But what really struck me about this story, which I knew this story, but I didn't know that somebody tried to replicate it. A guy called Brian Meyer replicated it about 3 years ago. He wanted to investigate whether people responded differently to a Merry Christmas versus a Happy Holidays, but he couldn't investigate that theory because nobody replied. Basically, he sent out 800 cards and he got about 10 replies. So the reply rate collapsed from 20% to less than 2%.
And you don't think this is just a standard replication crisis? You think something has actually changed?
Well, it was replicated as well about 20 years ago, and it replicated absolutely perfectly. So this is that something has changed, I think.
Anna, what's your theory?
Well, I mean, I think it's just in general, people don't send as much in the mail now. I mean, I've even seen this with my own family because, you know, my parents' generation and even right below, like, they all sent cards. Whereas now, like, me and my sisters and our generation, a lot of people don't until they have kids. And if they don't have kids, they just never send cards. The social tradition is just changing.
I think that's exactly it. It's not that people, I mean, you were talking a little bit, Tim, about how, like, people get a little bit skeeved out by receiving a Christmas card from someone they don't know. But I think a lot of it is they were perfectly happy to reply, except for they don't reply with physical mail anymore. That's not how they communicate. And if they don't have the email address of that person, then they just won't reply.
So I think, I don't think it's just that people don't send as many Christmas cards, because, I mean, people still do send Christmas cards, just not as many. And presumably, if you get a Christmas card, then that's kind of a more special thing and maybe more demanding of a reply.
Yeah, but you would still want to reply just by attaching an email, right?
You might well. But I think what's going on is previously, when in the 1970s, people got these Christmas cards from strangers and they didn't know they were Christmas cards from strangers. They were like, I don't remember who Joyce and Phil are. That's terrible of me. And people would make inquiries. People would try really hard to figure out who Joyce and Phil were. Whereas nowadays, you get a Christmas card from Brian Meyer, and you're like, I don't think I know a Brian Meyer. You check your Facebook friends. You check your email contacts. You search on Gmail. You're like, I don't know a Brian Meyer. I just got a Christmas card from a total stranger. That's weird. So I think people knew it was from a stranger, whereas previously they assumed they must just be being forgetful.
Or it's maybe not as weird because we all get mail all the time, which is sort of fake personalized.
And ignore
from
it.
From people that we don't know. And like, we now live in a world of where, I don't know about you guys, but I would say that 90% of the mail I get is junk, and 90% of the junk mail pretends to be personalized. So things which pretend to be personalized get thrown in the trash every day in my household.
You're going to be telling me next, Felix, that your Facebook friends are not really your friends.
That's a whole, like, ontological question, which I'm not sure I want to go into.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Let's have a numbers round. I'm going to start with 130 million, which is the number of space debris objects in orbit, which are larger than a millimeter. And if you're in orbit and you're, even if you're just a millimeter, you can cause a lot of damage if you bump into something, if you crash into something. But there are some huge ones. There are 5,400 objects which are bigger than a meter. And no one wants to crash into one of those. The amount of space junk in orbit, we've known that space junk is a huge issue for decades, but it's now just an enormous issue.
So it's like, I like this, Felix, that you're like, happy holidays. The apocalypse is coming.
It's only coming if you're in orbit, though. So the
in terms of
cautionary tales, the lesson here is don't go into orbit.
Yes. What people are really worried about is that one big piece of space junk hits another big piece of space junk and just makes lots and lots of little baby pieces.
Which has happened. That does actually happen and has happened. And it's one of the reasons why there's 130 million little pieces.
Yeah. I wonder how little the pieces can get and still be a problem, because presumably many of these pieces you just can't even track because they're too small.
It's true. Do you have a number, Tim?
I do have a number. I have a Christmas number for you. It is 0.3%. Any guesses?
It's Christmas. Anna?
I'm not sure.
Is this something to do with
Santa Claus?
Like the statistical route of Santa's sleigh when he's delivering presents?
It's not fair of me to ask, because the numbers are always mysterious. 0.3% is the contribution of Christmas spending to the US economy, as calculated by Joel Waldfogel.
He of the dead weight loss of Christmas, which is the standard subject of every single lazy columnist come around Christmas time. They're like, oh, let me talk about
loss of Christmas. But this time I'm talking about Christmas cards, so I'm varying things.
But 0.3% is how much the U.S. economy can sensibly be attributed to Christmas.
To Christmas spending, yes. And the way that Waldfogel does this is he basically compares retail spending in November with December and with January. And it's higher in December. So that's a rough and ready way of measuring the Christmas boom. And I think for a lot of people, they would be surprised that it's that small. It's also, by the way, it used to be bigger in the US. It used to be three times bigger.
Oh my God, I want to see the time series.
It used to be bigger, and it also is bigger in certain other countries. So people who worry about modern Christmas consumerism in the US, you know, could it be much worse?
I kind of think it makes sense, right? Because as consumption becomes a bigger and bigger part of the economy, you're going to be consuming more all year long. So whereas in the past,
day,
that would have been, you know, you, exactly.
Absolutely.
Anna, do you have a number?
I do. Mine is 4%. So there was a Pew study related to Christmas, and this is supposedly so 4% of Americans say the thing they most look forward to in Christmas is giving and getting gifts. And I think that Americans are lying, because I'm like, that is nonsense. They're like, 70% is spending time with family and friends. And that's lovely. But like, I'm sorry. I don't buy it.
You think they're giving the politically correct answer?
Agreed.
So happy holidays to everyone. And many thanks to Tim for squeezing into an Oxfordshire soundproof studio with me.
It's been a delight to squeeze anywhere with you, Felix.
We will squeeze further on the next time I'm in the UK. Many thanks to the good folks at Soundworks Studios in Oxfordshire for hosting us. Many thanks to Jessamine Molly for producing. Many thanks to you all for listening. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.